what's for supper?
What? What?
You never watched Hee-Haw when you were a kid? That was a great bit. Grandpa Hee-Haw. Jones. Yeah.
Hee-Haw, how old of a reference are we going back to? What, you never watched Moonlighters on the first TV network when it came out?
That was my childhood, watching Hee-Haw on a Saturday. They'd go, hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? And then they'd have this Grandpa Jones who would be sitting there, like, pretending to wash a window, and then he'd put his hand through the window pane, and he'd go, we've got corned beef cabbage in the pot, fresh ripe tomatoes you'll like a lot, and apple dumplings with sauce to spare, and a pitcher of cold milk to round out the fare.
Well, what?
It would always be the same thing. It would be, hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? And then you do this, like, country rap about food, and then they would put the laugh track on, do a crash cut to Misty Rowe out in the field with some guy, and it was, cue Randy Travis, and you got a show.
Wait, there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, you're being very generous with the phrase country rap. I don't know that I would describe anything that bad poetry, that dime store poetry, as being rap. What year was this, if you
this
had to guess?
This would have been the...
Let's date you for all fun.
Oh, yeah. This is the late to mid-70s, because it was about the same time, like our Saturday night was, you watch Hee-Haw, The Muppet Show, Sha-na-na, and then go to bed.
Sha-na-na!
Sha-na-na!
Oh, my God!
Sha-na-na!
Sha-na-na! Oh, geez,
you never watched Sha-na-na?
That is a word that I have, or a phrase that I have not thought of in decades.
Yeah.
Sha-na-na.
Dude, they were a big, they were in Woodstock.
No, they weren't.
Sha-na-na played at Woodstock. Look it up. See if I'm wrong.
All right, so wait, we're talking about Sha-na-na, the knockoff Grease, right?
The Grease hip, not hip-hop, you got hip-hop in my mind. The Grease doo-wop show band Sha-na-na. They played at Woodstock.
They did not play at Woodstock. Janis Joplin played at Woodstock.
The Who, Country Mike and the Jug Band there, and...
Country Mike and the Jug Band? That sounds like a Muppet band. Country Mike and the... Hold on. The Sha-na-na, wasn't that a created band? That was like the Monkees.
Yeah,
somebody created Sha-na-na.
It was just for show, yeah. It was...
So why were they at... Hold on, we're going to look this up. Why were they at Woodstock?
Opening for somebody, I'm sure they needed guests on the show. They needed bands, while the other bands were setting up, and Sha-na-na was it. They went.
So
out.
They're like they reached out to like the most commercially hack band they could find.
Well, that's
like,
a really
we
good...
can't get the Monkees, so we're gonna get Sha-na-na.
That's a good question. Like I'd love to know the story about how Sha-na-na got booked there, because either they reached out to them or Sha-na-na had like a new hotshot agent. That was like, no, trust me, this is going to be big. You guys, pack your stuff.
Because wasn't Woodstock, like, Sha-na-na was all about money, but Woodstock was all about, like, I'm going to pay for this sandwich with a poem and a flower or something, right?
Who knows? I have no idea. But
okay,
since...
oh my God. I looked it up now on Wikipedia, Brad.
Yeah.
Do you want to know who Sha-na-na played right before, who they opened up for?
Oh, that's a good question. I've seen...
This is going to blow your mind. Sha-na-na at Woodstock. Everybody's naked in the mud doing a ton of LSD or whatever they're doing. Sha-na-na comes on the stage. Guess who played right after Sha-na-na at Woodstock,
who?
Brad?
Who?
Jimi Hendrix.
No way!
Arguably one of the greatest musicians of the 20th century. One of the most amazing guitarists and vocalists and oh my God.
Oh, so you went from Sha-na-na to that Star Spangled Banner riff?
To the Star Spangled Banner where he, oh my God.
Could you imagine being out there at Woodstock, blown out on LSD, and watching, first, you're waiting for Hendrix to come on, but first, as your LSD just starts to hit, a bunch of guys with slicked back hair, gold lame jumpsuits, go running out on stage and do those high need running in place bits that they used to do. Could you imagine that? That would have been amazing.
Also, Jimi Hendrix had to work every second of his life for his musical talent. Bowser probably had to go to a casting call outside of Cleveland and had the right hair and then got the job of Bowser.
Not only was Bowser an excellent musician, but he studied opera to get his...
What's happening?
We reach back and I pull back my Sha-na-na memorabilia. It was, I don't know whether you grew up with this, but as TV was starting to blossom, just as cable TV, well, it was just before cable TV or somewhere during that transition point, on local network TV, they had something called PM Magazine that they would do these pieces, but then your local news hosts would record intros and outros, so it looked like they were doing PM Magazine. Anyway, it was a PM Magazine interview with Bowser, and they went and showed how he studied opera and everything be the bass man for Sha-na-na. He was quite an accomplished musician in his own right.
All right. Switch gears for a minute. Yeah. Imagine you're the stage manager, right? And Jimi Hendrix is walking up to you. And Jimi Hendrix looks at you and goes, "All right, so who's the Honey Love Moonchild that's playing before me?" And you're like, "Jimmy, oh man, we're so excited to have you. Thanks so much for coming, driving out here." And Jimmy goes, yeah, but again, who's the sweet honey rainbow kid that's playing in front of me?
Yeah.
And you're like, "Jimmy, oh, we're so excited. We can't wait to see you. Saw your set list. We're really excited for this." Yeah, but who's playing in front of me? We got Sha-na-na. Sha-na-na is going to be playing.
Jimmy looks at him and says, did you just develop a stutter? Sha-na-na-na-na.
Like he went up to them going like, "Hey, can I request that Janice play in front of me?" They're like, "No, we got Sha-na-na in front of you.
We got Bowser in front of you, but listen, we hear he's a very accomplished musician."
But you know he studied opera. Anyway. On that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show ostensibly about Sha-na-na, but also about making comics.
And making a living from yip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-dip-
soft friend wearing a leather jacket, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon, and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Well, let's talk comics, my friend. And before we go on, I just realized that I messed up my own joke. I was trying to say honeymooners when you brought up Sha-na-na or whatever, and I said moonlighters. Moonshiners or whatever. But it was honeymooners. That was the joke. Anyway, good job, me. 20 minutes later, quick with a joke, Dave Kellett gets the reference wrong, but quick with a joke.
Well, listen, let's jump right into our questions from our $5 level Patreon backers. I've got one that I'm really going to be interested in hearing your thoughts on. Okay. This was sent in by Patreon backer Lindsay Hornsby, who says, my question is specific to my husband's current comic situation.
Okay.
He recently decided to spin down his webcomic to work on a new project he's pitching to publishers. He started his Patreon specifically for his webcomic back in 2015. Most of his members joined based on that webcomic and getting rewards that fit that specific niche the webcomic targeted. My husband told his Patreon subscribers and general readers about his comic ending back in September and posted the last comic after Christmas. He knew he would lose some Patreon subscribers because he wasn't going to do the same types of rewards that were so similar to his old comic. What's your advice for a creator who starts a Patreon based on a specific project, then moves on to a new project? We assumed he would lose some members, but my husband is discouraged at the amount that dropped and wants to avoid losing more. He's already changed his reward tiers to reflect he's not doing rewards based on his old comic anymore. Dave, this is something that I think a lot of people face. They start their Patreon, then they've got to change it. They're scared to change it because of this very situation. They're scared of losing Patreon members that they worked so hard to get in the first point. How do you handle something like that?
This is a great question. And this is something we will all, Brad and myself included, face in our careers at different points. We have already faced it. And so what an interesting question. So let's start big picture. Brad, yeah. Just out of curiosity, when you advise someone to start a Patreon, do you advise them to start a Brad Geiger Patreon or an Evil Inc. by Brad Geiger Patreon? Which one do you tend to steer people towards?
In general, I say that you should be branding yourself as an artist, not necessarily the thing, because mm-hmm. for this very reason, you're going to change so much over a career that it's kind of dopey to pen it right to the thing you're doing right now. So especially for Patreon, which is intensely personal, I brand the person, not the feature. I bet you agree.
I disagree. I know that our friend Chris Straub has done that with his, because he's mm-hmm. got, you know, multifaceted projects going on at all the time. And I know that you have rolled in, God, probably 4 titles into your Patreon, right? But for me, I keep all mine separate. I have Comic Lab with you separate from Drive, which is separate from Sheldon. Mm-hmm. And I've liked that because I can manage and see how each one is doing respectively, and I know how to devote my time accordingly. Like, it's hard once people have signed up for a Dave Kellett Patreon. I don't know if I should give more time to Sheldon or for Drive. But with Patreon, I know, I should give much more time to Drive. It's making whatever, true. 6 to 7 times what Sheldon's making. So I need to put more time on Drive. And so for me, that's been helpful. But it's also, for me, keeping them separate is helpful. And maybe you would argue the opposite for transitions like this. Because my answer is not going to be helpful to this reader, to this lovely couple that's written in. But maybe my advice can help the next person that faces this problem, which is, if you know or sense that you are ready for a transition to a new project, if you're done with what you're currently doing, but know you have a new spark, right? Something that's firing you up, which both Brad and I support, and that's a natural thing for artists. It's fine.
Oh, yeah.
But I would petition folks to have a long transitionary period between projects where both of them are going, maybe at a reduced level, but they're both going. Because if you flip the switch off of a room and walk into the next room, you can't suddenly be surprised that the room where the lights are switched off is no longer providing you a Patreon income. Boy, that metaphor broke apart, but you know what I mean?
Like, how about the room is no longer lit?
Yeah, the room is, and so everyone's leaving the room. You can't be surprised that everyone's leaving the room. That's, you know what? The metaphor was right in front of me, Brad. If you turn off the lights to the party, you can't be surprised when everybody leaves the party. Yeah, that's what
there's your metaphor.
And so what you want to do is you want to say, hey, guys, we're out of chips and dips and beer, but there's another party right next door that we just put out cold cuts and wine. It's a different party, but it's still posted by the same people. Again, my metaphor is really getting tenuous here.
No, I'm loving your metaphor because I'm going to point out why I disagree with you.
Okay.
You got two parties going in two different houses. You turn the lights off at house number one. Now everybody's got to figure out how to get directions to house number two. Whereas if you brand the artist instead of the title, you've got two parties going on at two rooms. If you dim the lights talking about transition, in other words, you're doing them both for a little while. If you dim the lights in one, well, maybe that's a makeout session, but following the metaphor, people can go from one room to the other in the same house.
Yeah, for me, I really don't like the branding of, hey, Brad Geiger's doing 9 titles. Which one do you like? Oh, you like Evil Inc.? Then come back Patreon.
What's wrong with that?
Because your reward tiers are going to be all skewed towards this title or that title. And then these other stuff, like, let's say you just wanted to focus on Cape, Brad.
Right.
And you were like, nope, to heck with Evil, I'm just going to do that. And then, how would you transition your reward tiers and stuff, which are also heavily slanted towards Evil Inc.? How would you do that?
I would put one reward tier where I would make Cape a exclusive at this particular tier and see how many people migrated to it.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
This is not complicated stuff.
I feel like my answer is not complicated. This is so rare for us to disagree. I feel like mine is not complicated. This is, by the way, my answer is what Brad did from Greystone into Evil Inc. So to heck with Brad. He did what I'm saying to do, which is transitionary period.
Pre-Patreon.
Right. Pre-pay. God, that's hard to say. Pre. Oh, my God. You found some kind of tongue twister. Pre-Patreon. I got there. All right. That's been Comic Lab for the week, everybody.
But I will co-sign what Dave said. And that was for a long time. And I'm surprised you remember this. But for maybe a couple of months, when I said I was transitioning to Evil Inc., I had the Evil Inc. comic updating at greystoneinn.net.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And vice versa. So that, and I would keep hitting in the blogs. Pretty soon, we're going to wind things down here at Greystone Inn. You're going to want to go over. You're going to want to bookmark Evil Inc. and so forth. But for this, so my thoughts in general on this, in the answer to this person's conundrum, is you kind of shot yourself in the foot from the sounds of it in that there wasn't a long transitional phase. However, you are going through a perfectly appropriate period of time in which you're going to lose some Patreon backers and you're going to have to earn the new ones just the way you earned the old ones. And to not get discouraged, there might have been a little bit better way to handle this transition. And for me, that is and always will be exclusive content, right? It's always going to be here. I'm going to give you some stuff that you can't get anyplace else. And that's going to be ticklish because reading in between the lines, if you're working on a new project that you're going to pitch to a publisher, obviously that publisher is not going to want to have that stuff seen anyplace else. They're going to want exclusivity. So you're going to have to do something in that transition to keep those folks around and to keep them happy. And frankly, if you've got a Patreon, if you've got a significant Patreon following based on that niche that you were drilling down into, I'm curious as to what made you decide to stop doing that. In other words, if you've got a certain amount of success, why leave that? Okay.
Now, there's a thousand reasons to leave that, though.
Why? Okay, tell me.
No, they're all creative, but there's a thousand reasons to leave that. Like business-wise, I agree with you. Like if you have a functioning mini mart, a corner store, you don't just shut it down.
Right.
But this isn't a functioning mini mart. This is a creative operation. And if you're not feeling it anymore, and if you after years and years and years, you're like, I'm just not feeling this anymore, and then you have a spark for a new project, I see why someone would transition.
Right.
That's not a surprise. To me, it's you can't be shocked if you close down that mini mart and no one is spending money on lettuce anymore when you don't carry lettuce anymore. You know, that's the thing.
Right. Yeah. In other words, following what you said, if you make a creative decision, you can't expect business rewards for your creative decision. You're going to have to make do with creative rewards
decision. That's why I'm saying you have to put on your business hat in this creative transitionary moment, which is you need to say, all right, I creatively need or want to make this transition to a new project, right? That's fine. That's okay. But then you put on your business hat and you say, okay, if I stop making all the stuff that all these patrons were coming for, that's a problem. Why would they ever want to keep patronizing me? So how do I get them over to the new project? And that's why I say a transition period. And I personally think the transition period is longer than you think it needs to be. I think it's like 6 to 12 months. It's a long time. It takes people a while, and it takes a lot of haranguing on your part to say, we're going to be making this change. What you're loving right now is wrapping up. Just a reminder, you're going to want to bookmark or go over here or do these four steps or whatever it is. If you enjoy my work, I promise you, you're going to love. I'm so excited for it. Here's a taste. In fact, here's one every week, a sample of the new thing that's coming, you know, like pre-launch it with your patrons, whatever it is. But make that transition because you cannot make it a cold break. It has to be like a lobster in a slowly boiling pot. My metaphors are getting so mixed. You're not boiling your readers. I'm sorry. Hold on. I'm gonna take
we've
that
gone
back.
From party to death.
You want to, you know what? You want to slowly transition people from the pool to the jacuzzi. You don't want to just throw them in.
I can get behind that.
From a frigidarium to a caldarium. Look at that. Roman references. Dave Kellett, frigidarium to a caldarium. There we go. Who's making Roman bath references? This cartoonist.
This guy here. Who's got I thumbs and is making Roman references?
Who's got I thumbs? Holy shit. Holy shit, that's the best joke of the week. Oh my God.
but I do want to say, being totally honest, and we've talked about this before, Dave, how many times have you been not tempted to completely quit Sheldon, but how many times has it crossed your mind, like, I really need to be putting more time towards Drive, and you were like, how much longer am I going to do Sheldon? Because without putting you on the spot, I've had the exact same thought for Evil Inc., where it's like, hey, After Dark is doing way better than Evil Inc. The logical move, the business move, would be do all After Dark and no Evil Inc. But then with the caveat that Evil Inc. brings people into After Dark, right?
Yeah.
But what I do instead is realize I need to keep both of those things going in tandem because they both form a different function in my own overall business. And I really have to wonder, just again, without second guessing your decision, where this decision to stop that thing that was working altogether came from. Because it sounds like you're having some very foreseeable problems that arose from that.
Yeah.
And of course you're going to lose Patreon backers. They came for the thing. You stopped giving them the thing. Now they're not there anymore. Right. And since you've done it in that way, you got to take your lumps and start to earn those new Patreon backers for the new thing.
Right. Like, you can't be shocked when people are like not subscribing to MoviePass anymore when MoviePass has gone bankrupt and no longer exists. Like, you're like, well, why did they stop subscribing? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So hold on. I want to talk about, because you raised a point that is separate but parallel, which is, I agree with you that Evil Inc. is the gateway drug, is the doorbuster, the Walmart doorbuster, if you will, to get people into your After Dark comics, which are infinitely more profitable for you, right? And I think in part, Sheldon is a necessary part of my ecosystem, even if I wanted to stop it, which is Sheldon, Brad. Okay, so Drive makes somewhere between 7 to 10 times more money than Sheldon does, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever told you that, but Sheldon has between 5 and 8 times more readers than Drive does.
Right.
So A, that's weird, but B, it also tells me that for whatever reason, sci-fi folks like to support sci-fi. I don't know. But anyway, what I'm getting at is that maybe it's the case where I need that ecosystem of X number of Sheldon readers so that X divided by 10 becomes Drive readers, you know? And you need Evil Inc. to exist to become the doorbuster to get people in the Walmart to become After Dark readers.
Absolutely. And it's the reason when I was thinking about this, I put out some feelers in terms of reader surveys and so forth. And I said, hey, how did you find my Patreon? Guess what? 70-something% of them found my Patreon through the Evil Inc. website.
Yep.
So any thoughts of scaling back on Evil Inc. went out the window because I'd be cutting my legs off. You know, I've got it. And it gives me obviously good things that I can continue to put out and publish that I'm proud of, and gives me an excuse to kind of practice different approaches to writing and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing. But if I would have totally decided to stop that, I would have ended up hurting myself an awful lot.
Yeah. And I will say this. I have two new projects that I'm, for lack of a better phrase, transitioning into in the next 6 months. One is going to be the children's book. One is the film project that I'm making with Fred Schroeder, my friend and I, who made Stripped, right?
Yeah.
So I will say that you're going to see me do a lot of this in the next couple months, which is on all my existing platforms, on Comic Lab, on Sheldon, on Drive, on both my Patreons, and in my past Kickstarters, I'm going to be mentioning these new products, or not products, these new projects, because you can't just mention it once and be like, huh, no one came to check it out. I mentioned it 6 months ago. I don't know. So what I'm saying is you've got to do it steadily, consistently in terms of transition, steadily, consistently, and it can't be a clean break. So for people that are facing down the problem like our questioner is doing, I think both Brad and I would recommend a transitionary period where a lot of advertising muscle goes towards, hey, go check out the new thing. Don't forget to bookmark the new thing. Hey, subscribe to the new thing. Hey, look at the new thing. And that will ease your existing readership into it. But anyway, Brad, let me jump into our next question. This comes in from Adam over at patreon.com/comiclab. And he says, hey, Brad and Dave, I'm a new comic creator, and I have a question regarding the improvement curve. Mm. Looking back on your respective comics, Evil Inc. Drive, is there anything that you might have done or avoided to help give the earlier part of your stories better continuity with what you are currently creating? Not character reference art or not character reference sheets for art, but perhaps with larger ideas for layout, for script. Thanks for the outstanding podcast. So, Brad, I throw this to you. Brad Geiger of now, looking back on Brad Geiger 5, 6, 7 years ago, what could that Brad Geiger, younger, more virile, handsomer, what could that Brad Geiger, thinner, what could that, still wide-eyed and hopeful about the future, not beaten down by life, what could that Brad Geiger have done? I like that as you said that, you went, huh? What could that Brad Geiger have done in terms of creating a better, smoother, more improved process for your storyline development on Evil Inc.?
Yeah, and the key word there is continuity, too. In other words, Continuity seems to be foremost in this question asker's mind. I got to tell you, I don't know. And I'm not sure I would have changed anything.
Yeah.
My one answer to this is always going to be, and it's true, I would have put a little bit more time into planning. I would have put a little bit more time into writing an outline and rewriting and getting further along in the writing process before I started drawing. That type of thing I would have done a lot more of, because I think that's just in general is good advice. However, I don't know that I would have done that much different. And that doesn't mean that I didn't make mistakes. What it means is I learned so much by making that mistakes. I'm not sure I would have given that experience up, especially since the mistakes, quote unquote, were all things that didn't add up to a whole lot. They were minor annoyances for me,
yeah, minor,
from a creative
exactly.
standpoint. But they were also creative challenges.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about this before, but I would like to reframe this question into what I think is actually a healthy process for someone creating a long form story over a long period of time, mm-hmm. which is different than a novel writer turning in a finished draft to an editor.
Yeah.
Right. That's a different process than what we as long form comics creators are doing in creating a long form comic online. Right. It's a different writing and creative process and tackle. To do. So the way I like to look at this is that past Dave, present Dave, and future Dave are all yes anding each other in an improv setting, right? And for those not familiar, yes anding is Brad gives me the setup for a joke. I don't negate it. I don't go against it. I say yes to whatever reality he has presented to me.
Yes.
And then I and it, I add to it, I build it up and I pass it back to him. And then he says, yes, you are a doctor, and here we are on the moon, right? So the important thing for improv to work is that you have to say yes to whatever presented reality is, because otherwise you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're negating whatever previous work had been done, and you're also destroying the flow of creativity, right? But mm-hmm. mostly you have to maintain the reality, however weird it's been presented to you, and then go from there, right? So if Brad's like, dang it, why did I give him that superpower of ice powers? That now in this situation, it ruins this moment 5 years later that he has these ice powers, right? I should have given him fire powers. That would have been better.
Right.
But present Brad goes, yes, and. He goes, I mean, it is what it is. It's been established now as a reality in the story that he has ice powers. So you know what? I'm just going to have to write around it. So it's something about this room is actually beneficial to ice powers. And now that's mm-hmm. how he's going to escape. Whatever it is, you get where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Is that it? Take it as a creative challenge and build on it. And so in regards to this questioner's approach, which I think is a wise thing, things to avoid. One is do your absolute best to set up the story as best you can. Mm-hmm. And then maintain an ability over the years to say yes and to past you. Don't be like, dang it, past me, you suck. Why did you do it this way? And that will happen. But then you've got to yes and it. Take it, like Brad said, as a creative challenge and go from there.
And that's the thing. That's the key to good writing, is not necessarily looking for mistakes to avoid. This is not like drywalling putting electricity in. This is not those types of things. This is organic. This is creative. So yeah, it's a good idea to say, I want to do this as well as can. What are some good practices? So on and so forth. But those are all going to be the things that you can kind of use a common sense approach. Of course, I'm going to say, spend a little extra time in your planning. Of course, I'm going to say, rewrite. Of course, I'm going to say, start with a good outline and stuff like that. But the rest of it, now that you've kind of started, it's not so much about worrying about not making mistakes and stuff. It's about looking at those things that will inevitably come up, those roadblocks and speed bumps and sudden left turns that always, always, always come up in a creative project. And instead of looking at that like, oh, that's a mistake I could have avoided, instead looking at that and says, that's a new challenge that I appreciate.
Right. And then I will say this too. I'm holding up for Brad to see my drive.
That. That's the Drive Story Bible.
The Drive Story Bible that I came up with 8 or 9 years ago. And Brad, how thick would you say that sucker is?
Oh, it's about as thick. It's thicker. It's not as thick as a phone book, which none of our, I'm trying to think of what I would compare that to because people don't, but it's about, I'd say 200 pages.
That's about right. It's about 200 pages of a story Bible. And then for those that don't know what a story Bible is, that's the outlines of a story. It's thoughts about where things are going to go 3, 4, 5 years from now. It's character sketches of background stuff that you might never use, literally might never use.
Yeah.
Historical data on the empire that I've written, maps and ship designs that I may or may not use. Everything that you can think of that could go into a story, you throw into a story Bible, right? Mm-hmm. And I did this for Drive. In fact, I overwrote for Drive in the story Bible. But I think the story has benefited from the fact that I, like Brad, try to create as much of a grounding for the world, like Brad did with Evil Link, before you start playing in that sandbox, right?
Yeah.
So know what the parameters of what does and doesn't happen within your created world, and the story flows a little bit easier so that if you get stuck, you go, no, that kind of thing, XYZ, would never happen in the story because we established a long time ago that that doesn't happen, right? Or this does happen, or this character will always make this reaction. And that's why it's right. Fun 200 pages in when they don't have that reaction, right? Whatever it is. A story Bible is a really great way, and you can find guides and examples online about how to create a good story Bible. Here's the thing. Like, I want to take an example about my story Bible, Brad, because this is instructive, I think, to the process. Mm-hmm. When I created the map for Drive, Brad, I don't know if you've ever looked at the map for Drive. It's basically just the Milky Way galaxy, and I started dividing things up. Here's Earth, right. Here's this, here's that, right? Here's different empires. And now, in the moment of that creation, it felt fun to put this empire over here, this empire over there. It doesn't feel all that consequential. But Brad, as the war in my story starts to unfold, maps are incredibly important, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, let me do a different example. Had Tolkien put Mordor on the other side of Saruman's White Tower, what a different war that would have been.
Yes.
But the fact that the two towers were squeezing Gondor from different sides creates a very different war, right?
Yes.
So whatever choice you make now in creating your map, or whatever choice Tolkien made in creating his map, he had to yes and himself. He had mm-hmm. to go, well, shit, that's the map I created. I guess now here's how the war's going to lay out. And the same thing is happening for me with Drive. Like, do I a little bit wish, Brad, that I had put one empire a tiny bit to the south so that a mm-hmm. certain problem wouldn't come up in the story that's about to come up? I absolutely do. But I've got to yes and it. I've got to go, well, shit, historically, that's going to be where the empire is. So now I've got to deal with it, right? Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, and again, I caution you against an oh shit attitude, although I know you're kind of doing
I'm being hyperbolic.
But again, take a look at that as an opportunity more than anything else, that you're going to be setting yourself up for a number of creative opportunities. Let's face it. There are very few outright mistakes you can make in your creative process.
What a great attitude to take. Yes. Keep going. Yeah. Sorry.
There are very few mistakes that you can make. Well, you know what? It's the same. God, my dad gave me a lot of good advice. And this one, I think, has some really nice parallels. When I was 20, I was like, should I do this or should I do that? Should I go work for this newspaper? Should I leave Michigan? Should I, you know, all these should I's. And he pulls me aside one time. He says, there's something you don't understand. You're 21 years old. You cannot make a mistake. There's nothing you can do at 21, short of murdering or robbing a bank. There's very few things that you can do at 21 years old that can really hurt you later in life. If you make the world's worst decision as to whether you should work at this newspaper, you've got decades to correct it, course change, and get back on track. You can't make a mistake at 21. Later on, when you're down the line, you got to be more careful. You've got to make when you're 30 and 40. Now, when you make decisions regarding retirement, you've got to put a little bit more time and effort and caution into those.
I would
say that creativity is very much the same thing. When you're launching something, when you're launching something new, you certainly do want to put some time and care into it, but there's no mistake that you could possibly make that you can't overcome later on.
I think that, that's incredibly good advice. Your dad's very wise. And especially, I think he's right, especially at the beginning of a thing.
Yeah.
Everything is course correctable. And we are not, to look at it a different way, you're not doing open heart surgery or neurosurgery one slip of the hand and it's all ruined, right? When we say yes anding is part of the process, remember that it's the fun part of the process. Like, that's the joy of like, oh, shoot, past Dave really screwed me on this section. But you know what? Yeah. Present Dave is going to find a way out. I'm going to be an escape artist in the story. And we're going to figure this out.
Present Dave does.
That's what
present Dave does. And present Dave is going to set up future Dave, and future Dave is going to appreciate that just as much.
And when future Brad gets to wrap up Evil Inc., he's going to bring it all home. He's going to figure out how to get all those loose ends, all those false starts and stops, all the character arcs to work, and future Brad is going to bring it home. So I think, see this as part of the challenge, part of the joy of the process. And if you reframe it that way, the yes ending becomes fun. And so it's not so much mistakes to avoid as how to best prepare future you for possible success. So plant seeds in stories, plant faults in characters and things like that, and then let future you play.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you the number of times I told my wife that. Future Brad is going to bring it home.
Know that I kept off from making a joke when you're like, my dad told me, what are you, 21? You can't make a mistake. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, 21-year-old Brad, he can't make a mistake. I wonder how much time present Brad has left. Present Brad better make some good choices.
I didn't tell you the full story. He said, present Brad, he goes, what are you, 21 years old? You can't possibly make a mistake. I made a mistake 21 years ago.
Just under 29, 22 years ago, I made a mistake. Anyway, turns out jug wine is not worth the savings.
Oh, the French. Dave, I've got another Patreon question from one of our Patreon backers, Mike Bose at patreon.com/comiclab. And Mike says, ever do a run of limited edition prints? Mike doesn't involve it. Mike's not into subject verb. He just starts right with the verb. No subject. Just start right at the verb.
I don't believe in an introductory pronoun. I'm right into the verb.
Yeah. ever do a run of limited edition prints? How does one hit the sweet spot in terms of cost versus quality? So limited edition prints, Dave, what do you got?
I was trying to answer with a verb, but I couldn't figure out the sentence structure, so I'm just going to go right into it. So Mike has a good question here.
Yeah.
So limited edition prints. So I have done many prints over the years. In fact, I'm looking at probably 4 dozen prints that I've done right now. They happen to be in a specific rack that I have. In some periods of my career, I have focused heavily on prints because you can do them in limited quantities, which is great in the sense that you can make a reasonably sized mistake. And Brad and I advocate for that a lot. Is that try when you're trying new things, don't swing for the fences of like, I'm taking out a third mortgage.
Yeah.
I'm going to print these books up.
Everything's coming up, Brad.
This is going to be the sweet one. Oh, God, what have I done? So like what I always liked about prints is that their testability is easy. You can bring them to market quickly. You send a file to whatever local printmaker you use and you print up 20, 30, 100, 200, whatever it is you're going to do. And it's a low-cost way to make some money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Downsides about prints, you can't charge an extraordinary amount for what they sometimes cost to make. So, Brad, I tend to like to charge 5 times cost to me for an item. It allows for breakage. It allows for lost items. It allows for profitability, God forbid, and making a living. A little thing that I like to do called making a living. So 5 times cost tends to be a ballpark that I try to shoot for.
Yeah.
And prints tend to come into the 3 to 4 times cost realm unless you're charging more. I tend to charge 10, 15. I think at some points I've charged 20 for prints. It's harder to go higher for the standard print, right? But I will say this. When Fred and I were making Stripped, our documentary about comics, Bill Watterson of Calvin and Hobbes kindly did the poster design for it. And I said to Bill, hey, do you mind if I make a poster about this? And it was a really awkward email to send Brad because I was like, I know that he's blown up in the past when people try to make or sell a thing, right?
Yeah.
And so with all respect and thanks in the world, because, my God, he drew our poster. He's Bill Watterson. And it was so, I said, do you mind, Bill, if we make a poster of this and sell it? And he was so generous, even in that moment. He was like, of course, it's your movie. You want a poster and you want to be able to sell it. Yes, of course, make a poster of it. And Brad, my relief was, oh, thank God. And because I didn't want to offend him. That was more separate from any $5, $10 that I was going to make on it. I just didn't want to offend his kindness, you know?
Right, right.
Of a kind of looking a gift horse in the mouth. Anyway, what I wanted to do, though, and the way I pitched it to him, it was I want to make it beautiful. I wanted to do a Mondo-style print, if you know Mondo.
Mm-hmm.
They do beautiful paper quality, beautiful print quality. And so Fred and I sourced a lot of printers, and we found one in Northern California that had beautiful stock paper. And when I say beautiful, I mean the paper alone costs like $5-$10. It was really nice. And then the print was, they talked in like poetic winemaking terms about the inks they used, and oh, you're going to love it. It's fantastic. The ink was hand squeezed from a flower in southern Greece. You're going to love it. You know, that kind of stuff. And so I knew it was going to be a beautiful print. And so for that one, we could charge more. And also, we did a limited edition. We made it literally printed on the print, blank slash 250, whatever it was, you know. And for that, you know, you get one of 250 or one of 500, whatever it is, was going to be. So for that one, we could charge more, and we did that one, and that was lovely. And it was more just fun to have created that into the world as a nice memento. I have, on occasion with Driver Sheldon, done small limited edition prints. And I found, Brad, in general, and I'm curious to hear your response to this, I have found that my audience for my limited edition prints is actually kind of the same size crowd as the people that would just buy my prints.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Like, if I print up a print, 100 people are going to buy it. If I make it a limited edition print, 100 people are going to buy it. You know, okay, well, great. That was fun.
Great. Great.
I don't know why.
Thanks for adding a number on that. Can I get
back
to my print?
I'm glad I put that slash 100 at the bottom. That was great. there is, what it does do when you make a limited edition, if you market it right, it creates a little sense, false or true, that there is a time limit on it. Like, hey, you might want to get on this if you want it because there's only 100 of them. And you can perhaps charge a little bit more, although I don't know that I would gouge for a limited edition print unless it's a version of what you're going to do anyway. As far as quality and quantity, I tend to produce them at the same quantity, which is on photo paper, photo quality paper, just gigantic, that I would produce for my normal prints, but I just make them a limited edition. Like, you know that when you buy a print from me, and this is, I will advise this. If you're going to say, I'm only going to do 100 of them, then you got to stick to, I'm only going to do 100 of them.
You can't get to
100.
You can't fly around with that.
Yeah, you can't get to 100 and then go, nah, I'm going to make another 100, you know, because then you put too fine a point on it, you're lying at that point, you know. So
that's fraud.
Brad, what are your thoughts about prints? I've been talking too long.
I don't have a whole lot to add because in my own personal experience, my audience has not supported prints. It's been a non-starter for me for the most part. And every time I do think about them, the profit margin and the return on investment for my time and my money is so small that it's like, hey, why do I even want to do this? They're difficult to transport. They're difficult to ship. You know,
you've got to now buy
those cardboard tubes because you can't mail them flat because they're going to get bent. So now you got to lightly roll them up. Now you got these tubes you're dealing with. There's just not enough upside for me. Even if my readers did support it, I don't know that I would spend the time. And then in my genre, like back when I used to go to comic conventions, you know, the one type of print that I could see my way clear to sell would be stuff that I don't own the intellectual property rights to create. I don't have the license to do that, right? If I did a Power Girl, if I did Batman, if I did that sort of thing, I could see them selling a lot better. But that's a line that personally I find very difficult to cross unless I can really make a clear argument that it is falling under fair use because I'm making a comment about the character. Aside from that, I don't feel comfortable. I know a lot of people do it. I know they make bank doing it. They've got many ways that they talk themselves into this being, you know, fair to do, and they're not they're perfectly legal. Blah blah blah. That's between you and you know your own conscience. For me, I didn't like it. I didn't see it being appropriate for me to draw other people's licensed characters, so I didn't. And when I crossed that off my list, the stuff that I did want to decide might make prints, my readers never, ever backed it up. So for me, I don't see it as being something that's really worth the amount of time. Plus, I just remember, Dave, for you, when I used to do tables right next to you, they were very delicate. They were very delicate for you to take to a show.
Well, yeah, I'm listening to your hesitations about why you don't do prints. And I have to say that as much as I led this conversation by saying, hey, there's a low cost to entry, low barrier to entry, very testable in terms of designs, you know, for not a lot of lost money, you can see whether a design works or not, which is all true. It's all all that is a very speaks to a print's advantage. But I will say that Beth and I've had this conversation with Beth where I've said out loud, I would like to transition away from doing prints.
Mm-hmm.
They make money. I have a lot of them. But here's some unfun facts about prints. You even slightly scratch it. You slightly ding a corner. Can't sell the dang thing, right? It's like handling a Fabergé egg, bringing them to Comic-Cons, right? So you have to bring 50 in order to make 40 sellable because the top five and the bottom five, somehow, no matter how well you pack them, they're going to get dinged or scratched or banged up, right?
Well, and then some yutz picks them up and you know, puts a fold or a crease into it or spill, you know, puts his sweaty drink down on the table and gets them moist. You know,
oh, my God.
There's a lot of stuff that can happen.
You wouldn't believe how many people put their drink on your table at Comic-Con and on top of your print. It drives me nuts. Also, with all the best love in the world, I say this as a parent, there's a lot of 3 to 6-year-olds that come up and go, I just had a hot dog with a lot of ketchup. Oh, I put my hands all over your print. La, 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 bye. I'm going to go look at Iron Man now.
Do you like finger painting? I do.
I do. You know, that kind of, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that happens a lot. And then I will also say, to Brad's point, they are hard to ship. You've got to hold a whole bunch of special supplies. Like I plastic bag them before I tube them. Just because they get thrown on front steps and get rained on or snowed on. So that's annoying. And in general, the biggest thing is that they are delicate. And the margins are not over the moon. So I'm transitioning away from prints. But again, if you want to try it, low cost to entry, fun to do, fun to test the design, fun to see if things are going all right for this or that idea. I don't know that I would necessarily recommend it, but good luck with it. How about that? That's a good way to put a button on that.
That's good luck with that.
I guess I'm neutral on it. Well, let me read the next one to you, Brad. This one comes in from Jeff Marks over at patreon.com/comiclab. And he says, Dave and Brad, can you share what you have done to protect your businesses in the event of an economic recession?
Mm-hmm.
What lessons did you learn from the previous recessions in 2007, 2008? Ramen. I remember those years. And what have you done? What have you done to soften the impact of an economic downturn in the future? Thanks for always providing excellent advice.
Always
Bradley
excellent.
J. Geiger of Philadelphia, PA. When the next recession hits, and they always hit, right now I think we're about, what, 10 years out from the last recession, 11 years out?
Yeah.
And looking at it historically, aside from the good run that maybe Australia has had for the last few decades, not a lot of countries have been recession-free for much longer than a decade. So we're probably due for one in the downturn. There's a bit of a housing bubble. There's a lot of things going wrong. Maybe this coronavirus is going to spread to a global pandemic. You don't know.
Yeah.
A lot of things could trivial. Anyway. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, we're on the edge of a recession, Brad.
Yeah.
What would you say? How did you prepare for the last one? Or what were the lessons learned from the last one that you've used now to prepare for the next one? What are some smart moves someone can make for their business?
Well, the one thing that we've got as web cartoonists, the one weapon we've got against a recession is that. If you look at the history of web comics, you take a look at some of those sites that started up in 2001, 2002, and you see that you can actually do really great comics storytelling on the web with very little. I mean, our current site now has 110 different doodads and add-ons and plugins, and there's all this stuff going on for good reason. You know, you want to make the best out of it. But if things get to a point where you've got to really scale back, and not only like an economic recession, but if something happens with the web, you know, we've talked before, now that we've lost net neutrality, we know that the internet companies are going to slowly turn the heat up. So we don't notice it immediately, but pretty soon it's going to be, oh yeah, well, you notice your internet connection isn't so great. That's because of, you know, bullshit reason number two and bullshit reason number three. However, we've got this new thing you can pay even more for. Wouldn't that be great? Right. If it comes to those sorts of issues, you realize that you can really, instead of having that huge image up that you've got now, you can economize with that and bring your your bandwidth down just by putting smaller and simpler images up and cutting all of the doodads off of your website.
Yeah, I think the one thing, the most helpful thing that Brad and I have in our back pocket is that we came up being scrappy, like having to be scrappy, because it's not like webcomics started for us with like, all right, Brad, so you've just quit your job at the paper. Here's your $200,000 check and you're ready to go. You know, it was so let's talk about what we need. I don't need a lot. I can get down to one computer. I can get down to a small space in my house working. You know, I can set up shop in a closet. I've done it before. I could do it again, you know. And Brad can get rid of his studio if he had to. He could get rid of that second computer. He could get back to all sorts of cheap, cost-saving ways to cartoon, like he mentioned before.
Yeah.
We don't need a lot. Here's the nice thing is that you don't need, unlike, say, a restaurant that has this existing rent every month that you got to pay or you're in trouble, or this existing food buy. Like what Brad needs at the end of the day is electricity for his Cintiq. I need some paper and a pen if I have to. And then you can make a go of it and make a go of it.
Just like that. There it is.
But here's the thing. I will also advise this. One of the greatest things my wife and I ever did for ourselves is being artists in Los Angeles. We saw a lot of our friends, Brad, make it really big and then lose it really big.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, hey, I sold a screenplay for $100,000 and then I can't get work for 3 years. Yeah. Well, $100,000 inarguably a lot of money. But then try to make that stretch over the year that you earned it and then the 3 years that you're not making anything else. Then you got to, the key has been savings. And so the friends that went out and like, I bought a new car and I got a better apartment and I got this and that and that. Oh, shit. Now I'm not making any money for 3 years. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what we learned is it's very much the ant and the grasshopper. When there's a heyday, sock a lot away. Sock as much as you can away. I always try to do it where we are saving in our best moments so that we have at least 6 months worth of savings so that if both Gloria and I lost our jobs, we could support our current existing livelihood for 6 months. Now, that doesn't happen overnight. Saving that much takes a little bit of cutting back on things. Mm-hmm. We would, when in our 20s and 30s, we would like not go out to parties and clubs and bars with friends. We would not go out to movies. We would not go out to dinner dates. And in order to save up that 6 months, and it's shitty while you're doing it, but once you have that 6 month savings, oh my God, the amount of relief as artists that we would feel when we had that was tremendous. And it enabled us to take bigger risks too, which was great.
Yeah. I still remember the day that that my kids came home from school and found out that I had cut cable and that we were just going to do Netflix moving forward, because it saved me well over $100 a month. It's like, guess what, guys? We don't have cable anymore. You know, we've got Netflix and I think Hulu and that was it at that point. They really had a hard time of it, but that's what needed to happen at that point.
Yeah. And also as a parent, you roll that into a life lesson. Like, well, that $1,200 is going to pay for a lot of our groceries. So, you know,
and you don't really need cable TV, but Dave's points are absolutely solid in that. Yes. Number one, we don't need much. Number two, savings is important. And the number three point that I want to add to this whole thing is that as you move forward as a web cartoonist, as you're kind of looking at, oh man, how am I saving for a recession? The other, a few episodes back, we had somebody say, hey, why don't you sell foreign rights and get your stuff translated and sign up with a publisher to do foreign rights, all of which have, would probably fit maybe somebody who's walking a different walk. And I had a really visceral reaction. I said, no, because that's also what I'm saving for a recession. All of my publishing rights, all of this archives, that I think the question asker said, it's
Brad, people can't see this at home, but I'm actively nodding because I know where you're going with this. Yes, keep going. Yes.
Yeah. It's like, it's like at some point I was like, no, the person said, your archives are just sitting there. Why don't you use them for foreign rights? And I had a really visceral, I went back and listened to the show. I had a really visceral reaction because of this reason. That's what I'm saying. My archives are never just sitting there. My archives, I'm using in 100 different ways. I'm going to be able to use in 100 different ways. And if some of recession hits, that's the first thing I'm going to do is go to those archives and find out different ways to package and use them.
I'm going to yes and Brad here, because I had a conversation that got me into some hot water with a friend in terms of accepting a publishing deal the other day, because my big phrase that I love to fall back on is own and control your own artwork.
Yeah.
Own and control your own career. And I know that makes me sometimes sound like Scrooge or something like, get off my lawn.
Yeah,
but it's not. When you own and control your own artwork, you're like a farmer that owns their own land. Mm-hmm. You can plant even in hard times. You can, you know what I mean? But if you're leasing your land and then there's hard times, you're up shit creek. How are you going to pay for that lease? You know, what I'm getting at is here is when you own and control it, is an asset even for lean times. Brad and I will find a way to make Evil Ink and Drive work in a recession because we own and control it. But guess what? If I'm like waiting on Andrews McMeel or Scholastic or Image or somebody to do for me in hard times what I could do for myself, I'm up shit creek. Yeah. And that's the truth. I remember in the lean years of the recession, Brad, people had to get either quit their comics or get a second or third jobs because they didn't own or control it, right? Yeah. They got that big publishing deal. Oh, hooray, look at me. I got X amount of check, and we were all applauding for them. Then when the recession hit, they're like, well, there's no more checks coming in, and the publisher has stopped promoting it, and I can't force them to promote it. They're not doing anything. So tell me again about webcomics, and then we get that conversation.
And worse yet, what happens during that recession, that when the publisher that you signed up with goes bankrupt, but they own your stuff. And now not only can you not get the rights to do your stuff, your own work again, you don't know who you've got to go to get it, because that's tied up in bankrupt court and nobody's bought it yet.
Yep. I will say this, though, Brad. The one thing that I do worry about for the next recession, we had something in our back pocket last time in 2009 when the big bubble burst that we don't have this time, which is advertising.
Yeah.
And that will make a big difference in the coming downturn. And I don't know how to replace it. And I'll tell you why. When I go to kickstart a book, when I go to ask for Patreon support, what I'm basically asking people is, hey, from your discretionary money in your bank account, from that extra couple, $3, $4, $5, that extra $30 for a Kickstarter, how about you take some of that discretionary fund and support the art you love? Right? And when everything's fine, when they've got a job, great. No problem supporting that Patreon. Yeah. No problem supporting the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
But when the downturn hits, a recession hits, and, you know, 5, 10, 15% of my readership might be, if not out of a job, on hard times, you know, on a reduced budget, that discretionary income goes away. And so in the past, in 2009, Brad, we had AdSense, we had whatever different ad platforms, I'm forgetting some of them now, that could say, hey, here's an extra $1,000, $2,000 a month, $3,000 a month, right? We don't have that anymore, that in a way that we had in 2009, because the third party flow of money in advertising was not as dependent as reader X having a job. It was sort of this, well, Ford is going to advertise, Coca-Cola is going to advertise, even in a downturn, you know? And that, because we have moved our business model away from that, I think that could be some trouble. What do you think, Brad?
Well, yeah, that's you're just reminding me. And that is the old story of cheap entertainment being recession proof. Right.
Yes.
Like they always used to say, during the Great Recession, movie houses were doing good business because it was cheap entertainment. People still needed that stress relief that that entertainment provides. Right. So movie houses were still selling tickets, even though it was the Depression. And webcomics were in that same category, in that people still went to read webcomics online during that recession. And the way we made our money was advertising. And now you've almost got to wonder whether if during the next recession, really what we need to be thinking about is what's the replacement for advertising? Is it a different type of advertising? Is it sponsorships? Is it product placement? You know, we at some point we need to get a new passive revenue stream in there and in place, and it might develop out of the necessity. You know, so many times, like the recession hits, everybody's got the same problem. One person develops something to address that problem. That person makes out like a bandit, and everybody else gets their head above water. You know, right. So it might be. And by the way, that's exactly what Patreon was. That's right. Exactly how Patreon came about.
I mean, if you look back to 2009, remember your income stream of 2009, people still need to buy clothes in a recession. It's not an accident that we all did T-shirts in a recession, because for an additional couple extra bucks of what it would cost you to just get a regular T-shirt, you could get an Eva Link shirt or a Sheldon shirt or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And so a lot of people, even low incomes, were like, yeah, sure, I'll get a shirt and support the artist. That's nice. I do need a shirt, you know, that kind of thing. So there are ways to work that. But I think savings is one. The awareness and the ability to downshift what you need is another one. And so in Brad's example, getting rid of cable, but also in your business example, like how could you cut costs very quickly in your comic making? And then honestly, one thing that Brad and I haven't mentioned, which is keeping your head on a swivel and being able to change on a dime. And that goes hand in hand with owning and controlling your business, because one of the reasons why Brad Geiger has survived when United Feature Syndicate didn't survive the last downturn is that Brad Geiger could turn on a dime, reduce his costs, reduce his expenditures, and own and control his work. And a lot of those strips that were with United Feature Syndicate couldn't turn on a dime. They didn't control it. And in fact, the syndicate itself couldn't make it work. So own and control it. Keep your head on a swivel. Turn on a dime. Reduce your costs. Build up your savings. And I think it's going to be hard. Don't get me wrong. A recession is never easy on anyone, but it is a survivable event for a cartoonist. And I think Brad hit it on the head. And my brother, who works in alcohol distribution, once made a joke about alcohol, Brad, that he goes, yeah, in great times, people like to throw a party. So alcohol sells well. In a recession, people are really sad. So alcohol sells well.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. So alcohol is pretty recession proof. But comics are kind of like that. People love to read comics when they're happy. They also, when their life is falling apart, people love to read comics, you know?
Right.
So there is a recessionary value towards a book, which can be read over and over again versus a one-time trip to the movies, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, I think that puts a button on that one.
Absolutely. And now it's time for a part of the show that we like to call Thank You for the Kind Words. Dave, I don't know whether you've seen this because we haven't discussed it yet. This comes in from MK. They are the artist and writer of Sea Legs. And it looks like this is coming out of the Republic of Korea, no less.
Oh,
So, but listen to what this person said. This warmed my heart. Coming in from Twitter, they say, what I've learned binge listening to Comic Lab podcast. One, rejection is part of the journey. It's how you deal with it that matters. Two, you are an artist, no matter what your day job is. And three, there will always be room for improvement. Just don't procrastinate on perfection. That is the nicest. Those are three themes that I think are among the most important things we talk about week after week on this show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's also a lot to like about this. I love also, separately from this, A, I love the kind words. Thank you for that. B, I actually really love the title Sea Legs. That's a great name for just a complete side note. Second of all, I did not know that Korea's official name was the Republic of Korea. I always get those confused. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea is the full name, or is DPRK is Northern Korea or Southern Korea? I always forget.
I would not hazard a guess because I'm sure I would get it wrong.
Okay, I just looked it up. DPRK is the North. So the Republic of Korea is South. I always forget which one is which in terms of the acronym there. Anyway, That is so exciting to hear that the Comic Lab show is being listened to in Korea. How lovely.
Yeah, and do check out this person's Twitter. Should I share the Twitter address?
Sure. Well, I don't know. Is that cool or not cool?
I don't know. I don't have permission, cool. So I'm not going to do it. But I will say this. This person can draw their butt off. The images they're posting are gorgeous. if the writing for Sea Legs is as good as the art, this is something we're all going to be reading in a few months. It's beautiful.
And again, to put a button on it, thank you for the kind words. Thank you for listening. We so appreciate the support. And a reminder that if you'd like to put a little ratings over on iTunes, it'd be a fun thing for us to include on a future show.
Absolutely. And here's something that I'd like to include on this show. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my Sha-na-na-loving friend, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend, the Sha-na-na-na-na Dave Kellett, co-director of Strip and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
The Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net, and this episode and all episodes was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And last but not least, Comic Lab is made possible by your kind support over at patreon.com/comiclab, so we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
Yip, 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 doom, 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 get a job.
Were we even together on that?
No, we started out. I'm going to blame it on the lag.
But yeah, you know what? That's a streaming lag, everybody. I promise you, we're such good singers.
In real life, we're like the opera-trained Bowser, just right there.
My singing is much like my physique. No one wants to see it. And when they actually do see it, they're like, oh God, I'm going to move away quickly.